Arr! He plucks from his face a beetle, about half an inch long and emitting green light as if bearing a candle within. He rolls his gaze wildly about. All round him, all over Cape Town, as 'twill prove, these insects, swept here over mountains and deserts, are falling. It is not a message from any beyond Mason knows of. It is an introduction to the rainy season. What did we respectfully request? Scandaroon, wasn't it? Only to be anointed with the supposed contents of our cowardly breeches and sent here, where they know how bad the seeing is. What madness are they about? We'll be lucky to see the sun here. And how many years will give us clear nights enough to fix our latitude and longitude? It wouldn't be like this in Scandaroon, Dixon agrees. They say 'tis nearly Europe there. Fabulous Scandaroon, sighs Mason. They are presently part-singing to a sort of medium-tempo Cuban rhythm. Scandaroon. I'd rather be in Scandaroon. Though 'twould have to be quite soon, this June, in Scandaroon. Not far away, lesser Asia, so they say. Minarets and palms a-sway, we might lounge about all day, stuffing our gobs with Turkish delight, securing our obs, then beginning the night. Crescent moon, caravan and muezzin's tune, I'll not be forgetting soon souvenirs of Scandaroon. What a hope! Rain rules now and shall until October. The girls follow Mason one afternoon up to the observatory, up onto the first slopes of the mountain where they are forbidden ever to go. Father says because of the African boys, they proclaim solemnly to Alstra, who laughs merrily. Boys, babies rather, stay close to me, I'll protect you. She wishes to add, 'tis not with them your debit grows, but with the African women from whom you take without pause or apology. But aloud says, just try to wear something over your hair. The only blonde they see up where we're going is when the commando ride through, and the sight of it sometimes causes them to act in haste. I shall let mine blow wild, Els cries. Cover my hair, Jet astonished, as I haven't better things to do. You'll want to keep it out of the wind, says Greet. And end up with shawl hair? I think not, Greet. But they are by now too far ascended for her to return home unaccompanied. They are ascended into Africa. At some point, all note that they can no longer hear the town. That is all it takes to deliver them into Africa. They can see the bay and the sea beyond and the ships and boats, but the girls have lost the voices and percussion and rough breath of the town. They are of the continent now, and the town is a spectacle and a museum of marvels, and the rain beetles are in song. And who gazes back upon it too long or even too sentimentally may never see it again, or may turn to salt and be white for eternity. Mason, far ahead of them, an earthen trudging among the lanes, appears to be making for a curious, squat, cylindric structure with a cone-shaped roof, perched high enough to keep above the morning fog, or so the astronomers hope. 'Tis a gnome's house, whispers Els. Jet is gazing at the ends of large fistfuls of her hair. Look at these. These should have been soaking in egg whites half an hour ago. Do you know what happens if I miss one day? They're already split beyond belief. Has anyone noticed the light? Inquires Greet. For the sun is darkening rapidly, whilst striking to a remarkable hellish red all surfaces that not so long ago were reflecting the simple daylight. What? Never been this close to the bullseye? Alstra smiles grimly. Welcome to the Droster Republic, missus. Up here, some believe the bullseye lives and goes about, selecting those it shall take. We must ask Mr. Mason for shelter, cries Jet. They flee, all shivers and screams, a splash up the hillside to the observatory, just as the storm breaks, arriving at the doorway soaked through. Mason is not cowering, he will later explain, though he is sorry if that's what it looked like, rather standing guard over the instruments, whilst Dixon, no less warily, opens the door, and in tumble the bunch of them, rowdy and wet. The carpenter of the Seahorse and his men have put up a structure, solid as a man-o'-war, tarred the roof and all the joints, rigged a couple of blocks in a gun-purchase arrangement, allowing the gentleman to slide the shutter open and closed from inside. Get her down to the water, step a mast, put up some canvas, and ye may sail her home, the carpenter assured them. It holds six snugly, less awkwardly if, as Jet and Els now discover, two lie together upon one astronomer's couch, as promptly do Alstra and Greet upon the other. The storm drums at the cone above, which sheds the rain in sheets. There is nothing to drink but Cape Madeira, a thick violet liquid one must get through six or seven bottles of, even to begin to feel at ease. There is no question of working, all drudgery logarithmic having been brought up to date, the clock seen to, the shutter tackle made secure. Now then, Mason rapping upon the table's edge with a sinister-looking fescue of ebony, whose list of uses simple indication does not quite exhaust, while the girls squirm pleasingly, as you young ladies have been kind enough to visit during school hours, we must be sure that your education advance upon some topic. Wherefore, our lesson for today shall be the forthcoming transit of Venus. Cries of, "Oh, please, sir," and "Not the transit of Venus." "Then what in the world are they up here for?" Dixon's eyeballs ingenuously gibbous, if not out of curiosity as to what we do. They all take looks at one another. Alstra, at length, detaching to smirk at Mason and cast her eyes heavenward, where the roar of the storm goes on unabating. Her blonde procuresses all begin to expostulate at once, and Mason understands that the vocal assaults of the vroom poultry are not inborn, but rather learned in this world from their owners. "Ladies, ladies," Mason calls. "You've seen her in the evening sky, you've wished upon her, and now for a short time will she be seen in the daylight, crossing the disk of the sun. And do make a wish, then, if you think it will help. For astronomers, who usually work at night, 'twill give us a chance to be up in the daytime. Through our whole gazing lives, Venus has been a tiny dot of light, going through phases like the moon, ever against the black face of eternity. But on the day of this transit, all shall suddenly reverse, as she is caught, dark, embodied, solid, against the face of the sun, a goddess descended from light to matter. And our job," Dixon adds, "is to observe her as she transits the face of the sun and write down the times as she comes and goes." "That's all. You could stay in England and do that," jaunty little chins and slender necks, posing and reposing, blonde girls laughing together, growing sticky and malapert. The girls are taken on a short but dizzying journey, straight up into the ether, until there beside them in the grayish starlight is the ancient, gravid earth, and the fescue become a wildless wand of light, striking upon it brilliantly white-hot arcs. Parallax. To an observer up at the North Cape, the track of the planet across the sun will appear much to the south of the same track as observed from down here at the Cape of Good Hope. The further apart the obs, north and south, that is, the better. It is the angular distance between that we wish to know. One day, someone sitting in a room will succeed in reducing all the observations from all round the world to a simple number of seconds and tenths of a second of arc, and that will be the parallax. Let us hope some of you are awake early enough to see the transit. Remember to keep both eyes open, and there will be the three bodies, lined up perfectly. The heliocentric system in its true mechanism, his artisanship, how pure. The girls keep their glances each looping round the others, like elaborately curled tresses, trying to see if they should be understanding this, or being cruel young beauties every one, even caring. Chapter 10. As planets do the sun, we orbit round God according to laws as elegant as Kepler's. God is as sensible to us as a sun to a planet. Though we do not see him, yet we know where in our orbits we run, when we are closer, when more distant, when in his light and when in shadow of our own making. We feel as components of gravity his love, his need, whatever it be that keeps us circling. Surely, if a planet be a living creature, then it knows, by something even more wondrous than human sight, where its sun shines, however far it lie. Reverend Wicks Cherrycoke, Unpublished Sermons. "Show us the orrery," suggests Pliny. "I get to light the sun," cries Pitt, dashing for the card table, where the tapers are kept in a drawer. Tenebrae finds herself in the general convergence upon the machine in the corner, quite close to her cousin Ethelmer, who is trying to remember how old she is. He cannot recall her looking quite this, he supposes, nubile. And how old does it make him, then? Briefly, he beholds the gray edge of a cloud of despair, promises himself to think about it later, smiles, and sallies, "Remember the time you snipped off a lock of your hair, and we fashioned it into a comet and placed it in the orrery?" "That grew back a long time ago, cousin. When you were quite a bit shorter as well, I almost had to sit down to kiss you hello. Yet now, that is dangerous territory, sir." "How so? An innocent peck upon the cheek of a child?" "Had you thought to inquire of the child?" Tenebrae's chin rising slowly. "You might have found your education furthered in ways unexpected, Thelmer." Ethelmer, for a split second, is gazing straight up into her nostrils, one of which now flares into pink illumination as Pitt's taper sets alight the central lanthorn of the orrery representing the sun. The other planets wait, all but humming, taut within their spidery linkages back to the crankshaft and the crank, held in the didactic grasp of the Reverend Cherry Coke. The twins, pushed to the back, content themselves with the movements of the outermost planets, Saturn and the new Georgian, but 3 years old. Dr. Nessel, the renowned German engineer, last spring showed up unexpectedly in Philadelphia, having traversed the sea under wartime conditions to add free of charge the new planet to the numerous orreries he had built in America. In each apparatus, he fashioned the planet a little differently. By the time he got to Philadelphia, he was applying to the miniature greenish-blue globes map molds of some intricacy, as if there were being revealed to him, one orrery at a time, a world with a history even longer than our own, a recognizable creator, oceans that had to be crossed, lands that had to be fought over, other species to be conquered. The children have since passed many an hour, lenses in hand, gazing upon this new world and becoming easy with it. They have imagined and partly composed a book, History of the New Planet, the twins providing the wars, and Bree the scientific inventions and useful crafts. Here, then, the Reverend, having smoothly cranked Venus, Earth, and the Sun into proper alignment, has seen from the Earth Venus. Here was to pass across the disk of the Sun. Seen from Cape Town, 5.5 hours, more or less, limb to limb. What observers must determine are the exact times this passage begins and ends. From a great many such observations round the world, and especially those widely separated north and south, might be reckoned the value of the solar parallax. What's that? Pitt and Pliny want to know. The size of the Earth in seconds of arc as seen by an observer upon the surface of the Sun. "Don't his feet get blistered?" hollers Pitt, with his brother goading him on. "Isn't he too busy hopping about? And what of his telescope? Won't it melt?" "All of these and more," replies the Reverend, making it super remarkable that through the magic of celestial trigonometry, to which you could certainly be applying yourselves, such measurements may yet be taken. As if the telescope, in mysterious wise, were transporting us safely through all the dangers of the awesome gulf of sky out to the object we wish to examine. A vector of desire. "Thank ye, Depew, the phrase exact." Depew is the son of Ivesley Spark, like Ethelmer, home on a visit from school, in this case from Cambridge, traveling the Atlantic to and fro by Falmouth packet as easily as taking the machine to Newcastle. He has shown an early aptitude with figures. "God be merciful to him," silently requests the Reverend. Somebody, somewhere in the world, watching the planet go dark against the sun, dark, mad, mortal, the goddess in quite another aspect indeed, cannot help blurting, exactly at the moment, from Sappho's Fragment 95, seeming to wreck thereby the ob. "O Hesperus, you bring back all that the bright day scattered. You bring in the sheep and the goat. You bring the child back to her mother." "Thank you for sharing that with us, recalling that this is a sunrise, dear. Rise, not sunset. Come, she's not yet detached. Let us see. Well, will you look at that? A sort of long black filament yet connects her to the limb of the sun, though she be moved well onto its face, much like an ink drop about to fall from the quill of a forgetful scribbler. sidewise, of course. Quick, someone, secure the time. This, or odd behavior like it, is going on all over the world all day long, that 5th and 6th of June, in Latin, in Chinese, in Polish, in silence, up on rooftops and mountain peaks, out of bedchamber windows, close together in the naked sunlight, whilst the wife minds the beats of the clock, through Gregorians and Newtonians, achromatic and rainbow-smeared brand-new reflectors made for the occasion, and ancient refractors of preposterous French focal lengths. Observers lie, they sit, they kneel, and witness something in the sky. Among those attending snouts earthwide, the moment of first contact produces a collective brain pang, as if for something lost and already unclaimable. After the years of preparation, the long and at best queasy voyaging, the station arrived at, the latitude and longitude well secured, the wreck of the transit, the day, the hour, the minute, and at last 'tis, hey, where am I? Astronomers will seek to record 4 instants of perfect tangency between Venus's disk and the Sun's. 2 are at ingress, external contact at the first touch from outside the Sun's limb, and then internal contact at the instant the small black disk finally detaches from the inner circumference of the great yellow one, Venus now standing alone against the face of the Sun. The other 2 come at egress, this time first internal, then external contact. And then 8 more years till the next, and for this generation, last opportunity. As if the creation's dark engineer had purposely arranged the intervals thus to provoke a certain instruction upon the limits to human grandeur imposed by mortality. The sky remains clouded up till the day of the transit, Friday the 5th of June. Both the Zeemans and the Vrooms speed about in unaccustomed bustle compared to the astronomers, who seem unnaturally calm. Dutch ado about nothing, Mason remarks. Dixon agrees, and they're usually so stolid, too. Els comes skidding across the floor in her stocking feet, heading for the kitchen with an apron's load of potatoes. Nothing to worry about, she cries, 'twill clear up in plenty of time. Even Cornelius is up on the roof, scanning the mists with a nautical spyglass, reporting upon hopeful winds and bright patches. 'Tis ever like this before a cloudless day, he assures them. The slaves speak inaudibly and are seen to gaze toward the mountains. They have never observed their owners behaving like this. They begin to smile, tentatively but directly, at Mason and Dixon, of whom one is insomniac and one is not. Afterward, none in the household will be able to agree which was which. Drops of what proves to be ketchup in the pantry suggest Dixon as the sleepless one, while a wine glass abandoned upon a chicken battery indicates Mason. The rattle watch make a point of coming by every hour and in front of Zeemon singing out the time of night, adding, "And all's clouded over yet." Somehow, everyone is awake at first light. The sun ascended in a thick haze and immediately entered a dark cloud, as Mason and Dixon will report later in the Philosophical Transactions. Clock time is 0 hours, 12 minutes, 0 seconds. 23 minutes later, they have their first sight of Venus. Each lies with his eye clapped to the snout of an identical 2.5-foot Gregorian reflector made by Mr. Short, with darkening nozzles by Mr. Bird. "Quite a tremor," Mason grumbles. "They'll have to ascend a bit more in the sky. And here comes this damned haze again." Upon first making out the planet, Dixon becomes as a sinner converted. "Hey, God in his glory!" "Steady," advises Mason in a vexed tone. Dixon remembers the tale Emerson loved to tell of Galileo before the cardinals, creaking to his feet after being forced to recant, muttering, "Nonetheless, it moves." Watch, patiently as before the minute hand of a clock, becomes still enough, and 'twould all begin to move. This, Dixon understands, is what Galileo was risking so much for, this majestic dawn heresy. "'Twas seeing not only our Creator about his work," he tells Mason later, "but Newton and Kepler, too, confirmed in theirs." The arrival, perfectly as calculated, the 3 bodies sliding into a single line. Eh, it put me in a daze for fair. Whatever the cause, the times he records are 2 to 4 seconds ahead of Mason's. With all the other corrections to make, now must we also introduce another, for observational impatience, supposes Mason, styling it Leonation, perhaps. As well might we correct for Tauricity, replies Dixon, or delays owing to caution inflexible. The girls have also been observers of the transit, having cajoled a sailor of their acquaintance into lending them a nautical spyglass, and smoked with sheep tallow candles their own darkening lenses, taking turns at the glass, even allowing their parents a peep now and then. Jet breathing, she's really there. Greet adding, right on time, too. And Els, we may imagine what Els was up to, and what transpired just as the last of the black filament, holding the planet to the inner limb of the sun, gave way, and she dropped, at last, full onto that mottled bright disk, dimmed by the lenses to a fierce moon that eyes might bear. As before the transit, the month of May crept unnaturally, so after it will June, July, August, and September hasten by miraculously, till early in October, when Captain Harold of the Mercury finds a lapse in the weather workable enough to embark the astronomers and take them to St. Helena in. By which time, everyone is more than ready for a change of company. The northwest rains have well possessed the town. All intrigue lies under moratorium, as if the goddess of love in her visitation had admonished all who would invoke her to search their hearts and try not to betray her quite so much. After the transit, astronomers and hosts walk about for days in deep stupor, like rakes and doxies after some great catastrophe of the passions. The Zeeman's servant difficulties being resolved, the astronomers return to that table, and for the next 4 months pursue lives of colorless rectitude, with the food, no better nor worse, waiting upon the winds. In the mountains, the bullseye is sovereign. All over town, impulse, chastened, increasingly defers to stolidity. Visiting Indian mystics go into trances they once believed mindless enough, which here prove ridottos of excess, beside the purposed rainy day inanition of the Dutch. The slaves, as if to preserve a secret invariance, grow more visible and distinct, their voices stronger and their music more pervasive, as if the rain were carrying these from distant parts of town. Johanna and the girls, after a brief few weeks in a nun-like withdrawal from the frivolous, Jet going so far as to cover her hair with a diaphanous wimple she has fashioned of curtain stuff, are all back to their old theatrics, this time to the delight of a trio of young company writers lately arrived at False Bay, Mr. Delver Warp and the brothers Valte, coming home from Bengal, non-nabobical as when they went out, with only enough in their pockets to draw the interest of Cape Bells, who are far less particular than the Vrooms, and fearful that if they don't get it, 'twill as soon be gambled away into the purses of sea-sharpers. Corrupted by India, yet poor, ungovernably lewd, yet unwrinkled, and withal, what a heaven-sent source of white blood are these lads. Johanna can almost see those babies now, up on the block, adorable enough to sell themselves, kicking their feet in the air and squealing. And she grows monomaniacal in her pursuit, whilst Ostra finds herself calculating which of the sprigs shall be easiest to seduce, and which, if any, more of a challenge. Presently, from across the backyards, jealously patrolled by their predatory hens, come once again sounds of feminine merriment. Mason looks over at Dixon. At least they're back to normal over there, he remarks. For a while I puzzled. Had the town undergone some abrupt conversion? Had I, without knowing it. Dixon recalls when Wesley came to preach at Newcastle, his first sermon in the Northeast. The congregation's immense, all the side and beyond transformed, belonging to the Spirit. It lasted for weeks after, though it may have been months for all I knew of time in those days. I was a lad, but I could make it out. Little by then surprised me, yet this was the canniest thing upon the coaly tyne since Harry Clasper outkeeled the lad from Hettonly Hole. Nothing like it again, that I've noticed, until this transit of Venus. This turning of soul, have thou felt it? They're beginning to talk to their slaves. Few, if any, beatings, though best to whisper, not to jeopardize it too much. The Dutch are afraid, Mason is able to contribute, unto death. Why, aye. So do I recollect myself, the first time it happened to me. Mason, suspicious, sniffing enthusiasm, to you, do they allow you to talk about that? I've been booted out of Raby meeting, haven't I? I can reveal all the mystic secrets I wish. One first must keep one's hat on one's head, correct? Aye, the spirit ever fancies a bonny hat. But the fairly principal thing is to sit quietly. It took me till well out of my youth to learn, though now I'm not sure I remember how any more. That's it? Sit quietly, and Christ will come? We spoke of it as the working of the Spirit within. 'Tis a distinct change from the everyday. Thou wouldn't be able to miss it, should it happen. Yet then, you say, it passes. It abides. 'Tis we who are ever recalled from it to tend to our various mortal requirements. And so another such visit soon becomes necessary, another great turning, and so forth. Howbeit, 'tis all desire, and desire but embodiment in the world of what Quakers have understood as grace. Starting about then, rain-bound, whenever he may, Mason contrives to sit in some shuttered room, as quietly as he knows how, waiting for a direct experience of Christ. But he keeps jumping up, to run and interrupt Dixon, who is trying to do the same with news of his progress. Jerry, I think it almost happened. Do you get a kind of rum sensation here, touching the center of his forehead? Is that it? Mason, first thou must sit, not jump up and down like that, and then sit quietly, quietly. Back they go, till Mason in his chair, falling asleep, topples with a great crash. Or Dixon decides he'll step out after all, nip down to the world's end, and see what the Cape outlawry may be up to. Little by little, as weeks pass, the turn of spirit Mason and Dixon imagine they have witnessed is reclaimed by the colony and by whatever haunts it. Any fear that things might ever change is abated. Masters and mistresses resume the abuse of their slaves, who reply in bush tongues, to which, soon enough hoarse with despair, with no hope of being understood, they return, as to childhood homes. Riding in and out of town now may often be observed white horsemen, carrying long rifles styled steerloops, each with an inverted silver star upon the cheekpiece. When Mason and Dixon encounter vrooms in the street, they bow and pass, with each exchange lapsing closer to silence. By the time the southeaster has advanced to the circumference of the day, there remains nothing to say to them, nor to any who have been their hosts. I warned you all, Mrs. DeBosch lilts, triumphant, did I not, every one? Nor should I be much surprised if those frightful instruments they brought have served quite another purpose here. When they leave the Cape, no one is there at the quay to say goodbye but Bonk, the police official who earlier greeted them. Good luck, fellows. Tell them at the desk I was not such a bad egg, no? What desk is that? Ask Mason and Dixon. What desk? In London, off some well-kept street, in a tidy house, there will be someone at a desk, to whom you'll tell all you have seen. Not in England, sir, Mason protests. For the first and final time they see him laugh, and glimpse an entire life apart from the castle, in which he must figure as a jolly drinking companion. You'll see, he calls as they depart for the ship in the bay. Good luck! Good luck! Ha, ha, ha! Resounding upon the water, ever widening between them. What made them leave home and set sail upon dangerous seas, determining where upon the globe they must go, was not, Pacey, any astrologists in the room, the heavenly event by itself, but rather that unshining assembly of human needs, of which Venus, at the instant of going dark, is the prime object, including certainly the Royal Society's need for the solar parallax, but what of the astronomer's own desires, which may have been less philosophical? Love, I knew it, Tenebris all but sighs, 'twas love for the planet herself. Nothing like your own, of course, beams her uncle. I recollect that when you were no more than 3, you saw Venus through your papa's fine Newtonian for the first time. 'Twas in the crescent phase, and you said, look, the little moon. You told us that you already knew the moon had a little moon, which it played with. We would go outdoors long after bedtime up to the pasture, she is pleased to recall. The observatory wasn't built yet. The ponies would all stand together, quite cross, and watch us as we came up, their eyes flashing in the light from our lanterns, and I always thought I could hear them muttering, for it was clear we were disturbing them. Did they bite you? Inquires Pitt. Hard, adds Pliny. She raises her hoop as if to hurl it at them. Do find a way, advises Aunt Euphrenia, careering into the room with her oboe and an armload of sheet music, to wrangle with less noise, or your old uncle will have to sell you as a brace to the Italians, rumored to live south of this city, where you shall have to learn to sing their vulgar airs and eat garlic every day, as shall everyone else. Hooray, shout Pitt and Pliny, for breakfast, too. Tra-la, say, food perversion, nothing to do with the cherry coke side of the family, sniffs Aunt Euphrenia, producing the most wicked-looking of knives and beginning very carefully to carve a reed for her instrument from a length of Schuylkill-side cane. Yes, lovely, isn't it? She nods after a while, as if responding to a pleasantry. 'Twas given me by the Sultan. Dear Mustafa, Stuffy we called him in the harem chambers amongst ourselves. When Bree, once and only once, made the mistake of both gasping and blurting, "Oh, Aunt, were you in a Turkish harem, really?" 'twas to turn a giant tap. Barbary pirates brought us actually as far as Aleppo. You recall the difficult years of 80 and 81? No, of course you couldn't. Levant company in an uproar, no place to get a drink, Ramadan all year round, it seemed. Howbeit, 'twas at the worst of those depredations that I took passage from Philadelphia upon that fateful tide, the moon reflected in Dock Creek, the songs of the Negroes upon the shore, disconsolate. Most of her tale, disguised artfully as traveler's narrative, proved quite outside the boundaries of the girl's innocence as of the twins' attention. Among the domes and minarets, the mountain peaks rising from the sea, the venomous snakes, miracle-mongering fakirs, intrigues over harem precedents, and diamonds as big as a girl's playfully clenched fist. 'Twas inconvenience which provided the recurring motrix of Euphrenia's adventures among the Turks, usually resolved by her charming the bystanders with a few appropriate notes from her oboe, upon which now, in fact, her reed shaped and fitted, she has begun to punctuate her brother Wix's tale with scraps of Ditters von Dittersdorf, transcriptions from Quantz, and the Scamozzetta from E. Glutoni. Chapter 11. The St. Helena of old had been as a paradise, avers Euphrenia. The orange and lemon groves, the coffee fields. Gone before your time, Euphie. Does that mean I am forbidden to mourn them? They are mine as much as anyone's to mourn. I'd be last to lay any sort of claim, says the Reverend. Whilst the astronomers were sailing there from the Cape, I was journeying on, quite the other way, to India, and then past India. St. Helena was a part of the tale that I missed, and along with it the Reverend Dr. Maskelyne, who has continued, even unto our day, as astronomer royal, publishing his almanac and doing his bit for global trade. Something wrong with that, Wix? Inquires Mr. Leespark. Only insofar as it is global and not celestial, replies the Reverend, with a holy smirk mastered in his first week of curacy. The merchant of purposeful explosion throws an arm across his brow. Your halo blinds me, sir. Aye, most Italian. Joy of it, I'm sure. More of this brandy ought to dim it some. Genial Uncle Lomax, grinning mischievously at his older brother, pours the Reverend another beakerful. From outside, frozen rain sweeps briefly, yet pointedly, at the glossy black window panes. Then how are we ever to know what happened among the three of them upon that little-known island? Uncle Ives a bit smug, everyone thinks. Well, let us see. Maskelyne was there the better part of a year, aware from early on that he could not obtain the observations he wanted owing to a defective plumb-line suspension on his sector. Yet there, annihilated, remaining. 29 years old, first time he's been away from home, and he's facing months in what proves to be, those whose bedtime is nigh, stop your ears, an infamous port of call, quite alone in the mid-Atlantic, a town left to shift as it may, dedicated to naught but the pleasures of sailors, which is to say, every species of misbehavior, speakable and not. Tides and lunars cannot have provided the Reverend Maskelyne full occupation. One is understandably curious as to what else may have befallen him. Something must have, the Reverend Cherry Coke agrees, else he should have emerged mad as all sooner or later go upon that island. An attack of reason, suggests Mr. Leespark. What's the mystery? Ethelmer shrugs. Didn't days take 24 hours to pass, as they do now? Bree peers through the candlelight. Why, cuz, how interesting. The idea in making port at St. Helena is to keep to windward, get southeast of the island, and let the trade winds carry you to the coast, which you then follow, generally northward, till you come round to the lee side and on into the harbor of Jamestown, where, despite appearances of shelter, the oceanic waves continue to beat without ceasing, the clamor wind-borne, up across the lines and the parade, all being reduced to geometry and optical illusion, even what is waiting there all around, what is never to be named directly. Once ashore, the astronomers hear the ocean everywhere, no wall thick, nor mind composed, nor valley remote enough to lose it. It shakes the ground and traverses the boot soles of the watch, high in the ravines. The floorboards of taverns register its rhythmic blows, as they have the years of thumps from the swinging boots of seamen, whose destinies were sometimes to include homicide, as if keeping faith with that same brutal pulse, waiting upon a moment, needing but the single sighting, sworn to, vanished, the terrible authorization. Though the sun nightly does set below the island's stark horizon, what Mason sees from his first nightfall there is darkness rising up out of the sea, where all the carelessly bright day it has lain as in a state of slumber, whilst at dawn that same darkness, almost palpably aware of his regard, appears to withdraw, consciously, to a certain depth below the Atlantic surface. In the astrology of this island, the sun must be reckoned of less importance than darkness incorporated as some integral, anti-luminary object, with its own motions, positions, and aspects. Black sheep of the family of planets, neither to be sacrificed to Hades nor spoken of by name. Sirius, which Maskelyne remains here to observe, is the island's zenith star, as is Gamma Draconis for Greenwich. Englishmen are born under the dragon, St. Helenians under the dog. At Ben Coulon, Mason and Dixon would have been under Inconstant Mira in the whale. These signs are the apocrypha of astrology. Every midnight, the baleful thing is there, crossing directly overhead, the yellow dog. There, inverted among the wires, all but flowing, treacly, as you'd say, would even a Portsmouth Poll wear such a vivid, unhealthy shade of yellow? A very small town clings to the edge of an interior that must be reckoned part of the other world. No change here is gradual. Events arrive suddenly. All distances are vast. The wind, brutal and pure, is there for its own reasons, and human life, any life, counts for close to naught. The town has begun to climb into the ravine behind it, and thus, averaged overall, to tilt toward the sea. After rainstorms, the water rushes downhill, in eagers and riffles and cataracts, through the town, rooftop to rooftop, in and out of windows, leaving behind a shivering dog from uphill, taking away the coffee pot, till leaving it in its turn somewhere else for a footstool, thus bartering its way out to sea. The horizon has little use for lengthy sunsets. Creatures of the ocean depths approach the shoreline as near as the little coves where the water abruptly becomes lavender and aquamarine, remaining to observe, deliberate in their movements, without fear. For years, travelers have reported that the further up into the country one climbs, the more the sea appears to lie above the island, as if suspended, and kept from falling fatally upon it through the operations of Mysterian impenetrable on the part of a guardian. As if in payments credited against the deluge, upon no sure basis of prediction, the great sea rollers will rise and come against the island, reaching higher than the town with the Jacobite name, though perhaps not quite to the ridgeline above it. For anyone deluded enough to remain down at sea level, there must come a moment when he finds himself looking upward at the crests approaching. The public trees, quite small in outline, below them. The cannon, the bastions, of no avail. Did he choose, more prudently, to escape to the heights, he might, from above, squinting into spray whose odor and taste are the life of the sea, behold a company of giant-robed beings, risen incalculably far away over the horizon, bound this way upon matters forever unexplained, moving blind and remorseless across the sea, as if the island did not exist. Not as spectacular, older residents declare, as the rollers of 50. Then, it seemed, 'twas the triumph of a sea gone mad, and the island must be lost. Being part of a general exodus to high ground, one may not pause for too long to gaze and reflect upon the fastnesses of empty water plain, the sun glare through the salt mists after the sleepless climb through the dark. The only choices within one's control, those between persistence and surrender. Within their first week upon the island, all visitors have this dream. Out upon Munden's Point stand a pair of gallows, simplified to pen strokes in the glare of this ocean sky. A visitor may lounge in the evening upon the platform behind the lines, and, as a visitor to London might gaze at St. Paul's, regard these more sinister forms in the failing north light, perhaps being led to meditate upon punishment or upon commerce. For commerce without slavery is unthinkable, whilst slavery must ever include, as an essential term, the gallows. Slavery without the gallows being as hollow and waste a proceeding as a crusade without the cross. Down at the end of the great ravine that runs up country from the sea, beneath the cliffs, along the batteries, in the evenings, islanders looking to catch the breeze will nightly promenade. If one ignores the guns darkly shining and the armed sentries, the island might be fancied an East Indiaman of uncertain size, and these crepuscular parades to and fro a passenger's turn upon her weather decks. Though at closer inspection, each fizz might suggest less a traveler's curiosity than some long-standing acquaintance with the glum, even among the women who appear each sunset. Besides those resident here for purposes of nautical amusement, the birds of passage through St. Helena make up a mixed flock. Convicts being transported to the South Seas for unladylike crimes in England, with St. Helena one of the steps in their purgatory. Young wives on their way out to India to join husbands in the Army and Navy, a tremble with tales, haunting the day like a shadow from just beneath the horizon ahead of the black hole of Calcutta. And company perpetuals, headed out, headed home, such shuttles upon the loom of trade as Mrs. Rowright, late of Portland, who keeps opium in her patchbox and commutes frequently enough upon the India run to have had four duels fought over her already, though she has yet to see her 20s out. Almost to a woman, they confess to strange and inexpressible feelings when the ship makes landfall. The desolate line of peaks, the oceanic sunlight, coming about to fetch the road, losing the trade wind at Sugarloaf Point, hugging the shore and playing the eddies. The identical routine, 'twas, oh God, are we here again? Whilst to first-timers another planet, somehow accessible from this. There's one a sop with the dew, Dixon remarks, in the claret-colored velvet there, with the Chinese shawl and the kid boots. She seems to recollect thee for fair. Tyburn Charlie, well prick me with a buskpin, and tell me 'twas all a dream. 'Tis I, little Florinda. Yes, you do remember, but last year. And she sings in a pleasant alto. 'Twas the 5th day of May, in the year of our Lord, 1760, that the brave Lord Ferrers ascended the steps of the scaffold, as bold as a hero. Mason, amiably joining in, they continue. I am ready, said he, if you'll quote me your fee. To the cruel hangman's eye sprang a tear-o. Of your silver-trimmed coat, I'll admit I made note, but must no longer claim it, oh dear, oh. Refrain. Oh my, oh dear, oh, you must think I've the morals of Nero. Be it dangle 'em high or strangle 'em low, hangmen have feelings, or didn't ye know? The year after Rebecca's death was treacherous ground for Mason, who was as apt to cross impulsively by ferry into the bosom of Wapping and another night of joyless, low debauchery as to attend routs in Chelsea, where nothing was available betwixt eye flirtation and the pox. In lower situated imitations of the Hellfire Club, he hurtled carelessly along some of Lust's less frequented footpaths. Ever further, he did not escape noting from pleasure the moonlight falling upon the lawns, the trees, the walks, claiming the color of desire as to represent all that passion seething within that small corner of town, the music through the leaves, each washed in moon white, to the fabulators of Grub Street, a licentious night world of rakes and whores, surviving only in memories of pleasure, small darting winged beings, untrustworthy as remembrancers. Yet its infected, fragrant, soiled encounters neath the moon were as worthy as any, an evil in innocence. Uncle, uncle, hum, hum, howbeit, another cup, sir? 'Twas then that Mason began his practice, each Friday, of going out to the hangings at Tyburn, expressly to chat up women, upon a number of assumptions, many of which would not widely be regarded as sane. Rolling out the Edgeware Road, to where they climb a ladder to go to sleep, the crowd is all a tiptoe, and the skies are bright. 'Tis a lovely day to come and have a peep. He'll drop right through the floor, tick-tock. He'll dance upon the air, knock. Knock. Whilst neath the deadly nevergreen, 'tis merry as a fair. And if you're lucky to be short enough, with no place much to stare, why, you might not even know you're there. Turned 32 but days before, Mason, as a gift of festivity to himself, attends the much heralded hanging of Lord Ferrers for the murder of Johnson, his steward. What seems the entire world of fashion has assembled, with each trying to outdress every other. Nonce hats, never before seen, many never to be seen again. Wigs, as elaborately detailed as gowns. Coats, especially commissioned for the occasion, with a classic 13-turn noose motif to the braiding and the smoking pistol depicted in gold brocade. As Mason, feeling shabby, curses himself for not having worn a more stylish outfit, he notes a young woman observing him. When he meets her gaze, she immediately switches it away with a look of annoyance. Not with Mason, it pleases him to fancy, so much as with herself, for happening to be the one caught staring, there being scores of good reasons why no further degree of fascination will develop from this. Judging by her escort, she's some rising beauty of the town, whose looks more than excuse an absolute lack of taste in any matter of costume, while at the same time she finds herself mysteriously drawn to snuff-colored and frankly murkier statements, such as Mason's here. "Hello, do you think you'll get much of a hard-on, then?" is her greeting. They say that agents of Lady F. are about, betting heavily against it. Mason gapes in despair. He'll be days late thinking up any reply to speech as sophisticated as this. In my experience, he might say, 'tis usually the innocent who get them, and the guilty who fail to. How very curious. She will not blink, though her nostrils may flare. Her escorts will titter, and her little dog Biscuit, alone scenting her onset of interest, will begin to act up. Could remorse ever really unman any of you? Why, no. 'Tis rather that surprise invigorates us. Flirtatiously, she scowls, as Mason goes rattling on morosely. Take the noted highwayman, Phepp, but last week, most likely not insane, being moved by the mathematics of his wealth, or rather lack of it, more than by any criminal passion, the membrum virile was remarkably flaccid, at least according to the jobbers who cut him down. And subsequently up, chirps the maiden. Or consider that the murderer cannot, in the moment, know the ecstatic surprise of the innocent, having borne within him from life's beginning an acquaintance with the sudden drop and snap of its end. He dreams about it sometimes when awake. He commits his fatal crime out of a need to reconverge upon that blinding moment where all his life was ever focused. Her eyes have grown enormous and moist. The bodice of her gown squeaks gently at its seams. Her modesty piece flutters as if itself perplexed. The fops accompanying her, having been freed to resume their chief interest, the exchange of gossip, even custodial eyes are elsewhere. "Sir," she murmurs, "I have ever sought a man such as yourself." There is a sudden roar from the crowd, half for and half against, as his lordship's carriage arrives, and the fourth earl steps out. Seamen throw unchewable sausages and half-eaten scones. Brightly dressed women throw roses. "Hideous suit," remarks one of the fops. "What's that shade? Some kind of fawn? Altogether too light for the occasion." "I do like the silver bits, though," comments his friend Seymour. All manner of retainers in black livery bustle about, the one attracting the most notice being the rope-bearer. for it is rumored that Lord Ferrers is to be hanged at his request with a rope of silk. The bearer is a slight figure in black velvet, whose skin in the high sunlight appears paper white. All the way from the tower, atop the bright jinglings of the carriage, expensively encrusted and plated by highly paid Italians, like a miniature propelled in its strange slow progress by some invisible child, is the fatal rope held aloft, perfectly white upon a black silk cushion for the inspection of all the straining eyes. Well, it's still imp for me, someone remarks, all things being equal, if not all men. Aye, silk's what they fancy out in India with their thuggee. Over the wall, in your window, job's done. Another tasty bite for old Kali. That's their goddess, as you'd say. Silk, it's scarcely there. And yet, precisely my point. Orange girls and beggars, ale pots, gaming in the dirt, purses wafted away, glances intercepted, dogs bravely aprowl for scraps as hungry blade men for dogs, buskers wandering and standing still, with a wind from the gallows bringing every sigh, groan, and ejaculation over the heads of the crowd to settle upon their hearing like ash upon the hats of spectators at a fire. The day wraps and fondles them as Mason and the temporarily heedless beauty move together through the crowd till they reach a barrel with the awnings rigged against the sun. Wine, cries she. Oh, let's do. This Chateau Gorse looks interesting, says Mason, although, as the day is mild, perhaps a chilled hock would be more apropos. If not de rigueur, she replies. But of course, chérie. They laugh at the piquance of these mots and sip wine as the imbecile peer goes along toward his doom, till some kind of problem arises with the new trapdoor arrangement, today's being its first use at any public proceeding. These frightful machines, she pretends to lament. Shall our deaths now, as well as our lives, be ruled by the philosophers and their army of mechanics? That trap's probably overconstructed, Mason has already blurted, hence too heavy and bearing sidewise upon the lever and catch. He notes a sudden drop in the local temperature. You are a man of science, then? Looking about, though not yet with panic. I am an astronomer, Mason replies. Ah, existing upon some sort of stipend, I imagine. How wonderful. I'd taken you for one of the better sort of kiddie, the way you were turned out, quiet self-possession, I mean. One usually is able to tell. Alas, 'tis just as Mr. Bub Doddington warned me. Florinda, said he, you are too young to appreciate men either in their wide diversity or for the pitiable simplicity of what they really want. Can you guess what that is, my wren? His wren. Well, it might have been one thing, mightn't it? And then again... Excuse me, did I hear you, I'm sure inadvertently, mention that you receive assessments of character from Bub Doddington, the ancient Fitch of legend? That relic from a signally squalid era in our nation's political history, that Bub Doddington? George is a particular friend, she flares in a way that suggests experience upon the stage. If he may advise the Princess of Wales as to matters constitutional, he may advise me whatever he wishes. He grows older, and a life of superhuman excess is at last presenting its bills, whose demands turn ever harsher with the days, even at the interest, yet a bargain. Will you have as much to say, stargazer, when it is your time? Mason lets his head drop abjectly. There's one, says Pierce, as he fell in the well. The truth is, madam, that I have envied your friend the honesty of his life, though being an earl helped, of course. If you mean that you envy his openness as to his desires, I collect there are things you yourself may wish to do that you haven't quite the words for. And gazing at him quite steadily, too. I? Mason's soul's beginning to ache, his brain unable to muster a thought. What he does not, consequently, understand is that having reckoned him harmless, she has decided to get in a bit of exercise, in that endless refining which the crafts of coquetry demand, using Mason as a sort of practice dummy. You did have me going, Florinda. Well, I hope so, I'm sure. Tell me, then, are you still gazing at the stars for simpleton silver? You remember that? Why, you're not saying, Charlie, that there are too many men in my life for me to remember. Surely 'tis not the aggregate total of all men, but how many kinds of men that matters. And that figure is manageable, thank ye. James's town, snug in its ravine, the watchfires high above keeping the knights from invasion, settles into the darkness. Smells of eastern cooking pour out the kitchen vents of the boarding houses and mix with that of the ocean. The town is for a moment an unlit riot of spices, pastry, fish and shellfish, penguin stafatas, and seabird fricassees. Upon the swiftly darkening sea prospect, in outline now appears a figure that lacks but a scythe in its grasp, to turn all thoughts upon the brevity of life. "Dadams," she cries, "over here. Charlie, my fiancé, Mr. Mourneval." I meet so many of Florrie's old troop. The tall, cadaverous personage, whose eyes cannot be clearly seen, hisses in the twilight. "Charlie, Charlie, you must have been one of the zanies." "Your theatrical sense, uncanny, sir," murmurs Mason. "Allow me to present my co-adjutor, whose repertoire of jest is second only to what resides in the Vatican Library, Mr. Dixon." A Chinaman, a Jesuit, and a Corsican are riding up to Bath. Chapter 12. Mason, Dixon, and Maskline are in a punch house on Cock Hill called The Moon, sitting like an allegorical sculpture titled Awkwardness. It is not easy to say which of them is contributing more to sustaining the tableau. Mason is suspicious of Maskline. Maskline struggles not to offend Mason, and Dixon and Maskline have been estranged from the instant Dixon, learning of Maskline's residence at Pembroke College, Cambridge, brought up the name of Christopher Smart. "Durham lad, he became a fellow at Pembroke." A gust of panic crosses Maskline's face briefly, then his curatical blank returns. "Mr. Smart was our perennial Seton Prize winner. He left 2 years after I arrived, our intimacy being limited to mealtimes, when I brought his food to the fellow's table and fetched away his soiled napery and his gnawed bones. Sometimes, after they'd all gone, we of the scullery would eat their leavings. His may have been among 'em. I did not distinguish closely. I was a lad, and not at all aware of how uncomfortable a life it must have been. To live at Cambridge, to step where Newton stepped, I would have become a servant's servant." "Newton is my deity," Dixon rather blurts, ignoring Maskline's efforts to show polite astonishment by raising one eyebrow without also raising the other. "And Mr. Smart, why, I knew him when I was small, a rather older lad who came to Raby on his school vacations, his father being steward of the Vane estates down in Kent, you see, as was my great-uncle George of Raby." Maskline now has his eyeballs rolled to heaven, as if praying for winged escape. So both of us quickly learned our way round the larders, the trysting places, the passageways inside the walls, where our errands often took us, Mr. Kitts being usually to or from the chapel. I can recall no one marking in him any unkind moment, though he did seem, each time he returned to Raby, a bit more preoccupied. "In 56, I believe, he was confined in a hospital for the insane," says Maskline, his field creature's eyes a-sparkle. "And released, I have heard, the year before last, mad as when he went in." "Why, aye," Dixon grimly beams, "it must have been the Raby Castle that did it to him." "Well, it certainly wasn't Pembroke," Maskline sniffs. "Indeed, 'twas only when poor Smart gave up Cambridge that his mind began to leave him." "Away from those healthy surroundings," Dixon replies with clenched amiability. There is commotion as the landlord, Mr. Blackner, and several regulars, leaning to hear, lose all idea of their centers of gravity and, staggering in the puddles of ale that commonly decorate the floor of the Moon, go crashing among the furniture. Mason, as if newly arrived, speaks at last. "Forget not London itself, as a preeminent author of madness. Greenwich to Grub Street, the place is not for everyone. Drawn though we be to the grandeur, the hundred villages strewn all up and down the great inlet from the sea, and the wide world beyond, yet for many the cost, how great." Maskline, choosing to hear in this a rebuke, snaps, "Perhaps too many damned gothical scribblers about. Far too many's what did for Mr. Smart. seeming in his turn to allude to Mason's earlier announced preferences in entertainment. As Mason considers some reply, Dixon gallantly fills in. "Why, Grub Street, Pub Street, sir. The Ghastly Fop? Vampires of Covent Garden? Come, come. Worth a dozen of any Tom Jones, sir." This received Maskelyne's careful smirk. He fancies it a smile, but 'tis an attitude of the mouth only. The eyes do not engage in it, being off upon business of their own. The impression is of unrelenting wariness. "I'd expect such to lie up Mr. Mason's lane. Hadn't supposed your own tastes to run there as well. Excellent way to pass those obless nights, I'd imagine, reading each to the other." Mr. Blackner has appeared. "I always fancied the one about the Italian with no head. That'd be now Count Senzacopo. Do any of you know that one?" "Excellent choice, sir," Dixon, as it seems, cheerily. "That episode with the three peasant girls. And those illustrations." The lad's lewdly chuckling. "Yet surely," Maskelyne all but whining, "there's far too much of it about. Encouraging," his voice dropping, "all these melancholic people." He gestures round the room with his head. "This island, especially, is full of them. 6 months I've been here. Too many idle minutes to be filled. Soon pile up, topple, and overwhelm the healthiest mind." "Serious business," cackles the proprietor, sliding away to other mischief. "Damn the fellow," Maskelyne clutching his head. "Something else coming here," Dixon advises. Mason looks up. "Ah, the natives from the kitchen, Maskelyne. What is it, a cannibal sacrifice?" "No," Maskelyne screams, "worse." "Worse," Dixon murmurs, by which time all can see the candles upon the great iced cake being borne out to them as its escort burst into "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow." Mr. Blackner brandishes an invisible spoon. "Assembled it myself, sir, though my apprentice here did the icing." "They found out," whispers Maskelyne. "But how? Do I talk in my sleep, whilst they listen at the door?"